Today on Life and Faith.
I mean, I was sitting in this, you know, very nice hotel lobby with just, you know, coming to tears, just remembering how much suffering there is, but also just how much hope there is for rescue and new life.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. Today we're bringing you two conversations recorded in 2012 and 2013. Now, both of these are with women who are deeply committed to justice and human flourishing and in their distinctive ways making a big contribution to those things. And that's really today's theme. In the second half of the podcast will be a conversation with Ruth Padilla de Borst. Ruth is based in Costa Rica, is a theologian, a wife and mother, educator and storyteller. And her story of personal tragedy is pretty confronting and compelling. Up first is Bethany Huang. Bethany is an author, a speaker, and a consultant to nonprofits committed to justice. And in particular, Bethany spent many years working for International Justice Mission. IJM is a human rights agency which seeks to end slavery and seek justice for victims of slavery in all its forms. And just a warning, today's podcast contains discussions that are not appropriate for small children. Here's Bethany Huang.
Well, another way to encapsulate the mission of what we do is that we're working to rescue thousands, but then to also protect millions of people. And overall, we want to prove that justice for the poor is possible. So right now, that's something that is, in most places of the world, it just seems impossible. There's so much corruption. There's so much intense violence and deception that is wreaking the most incredible havoc on the people who are the most vulnerable in our world. But what we've come to find is that when you one by one go after the people who are in need of rescue and the people who are perpetrating the abuse against them, when you bring the restraint of the law, when you prosecute those who are bringing the abuse, it starts to send a message to the entire system. So you can not only see individuals who are rescued become healed and find new life of freedom, but you can also send a message to entire systems of abuse and deception and corruption that selling children, for example, is just not going to be profitable anymore. So we're actually seeing quite a bit of hope, even though the work is hard.
It sounds really overwhelming. I guess working across international boundaries must be difficult, but you have a philosophy of getting local people doing a lot of this work.
Exactly, right. Yeah, about 90% of our staff or more are nationals to the countries where they do their work.
Mm. Now, tell us about how this organization started. There's a bit of a story there, right?
Right. So our founder, Gary Haugen, he was working within the Department of Justice, and he was working on police misconduct issues within the United States. But then in 1994, the Rwanda genocide hit in April of 1994. And during that time, you know, nearly a million people were slaughtered one by one with machetes. And it was just this mass destruction that happened over a very short period of time. And afterwards, there wasn't a lot of know-how about of what to do, how to even go about investigating this. And a lot of investigators were sent over to start looking into this crime. And basically, you had to start with the bodies. So you show up in Rwanda, and you just go to these mass graves. And when investigators were deployed by the UN, they actually picked Gary Haugen to be the chief investigator of that genocide. So he was in charge of leading teams to all of these different mass graves throughout the country. And most of the graves were actually in the churches because people had run to the churches to seek shelter. And then they were trapped inside of the churches, and that's where they were ultimately killed. So while Gary was in this place amongst all these different mass graves, it was there that he realized that the church people who were Christians all over the world had been silent in the face of this massacre, and that it actually could have been stopped, and that every single one of those people in these mass graves, 800,000 or more people, every single one of them was infinitely loved by the God who had created them. And that was the message that he wanted to see people who are Christians, who know this God of justice, rise up and share and demonstrate through the way they lived. So he was compelled to start International Justice Mission to do that.
Well, it's been going for a few years now. What are some of the good stories that are, there must be a lot of stuff that's pretty bleak, but there's some good stories coming out of this work.
Absolutely. One of my favorite stories from recently is in South Asia, there is just an enormous amount of labor slavery, of people who are toiling, more than 16 hours a day under just incredible heat, but also incredible violence and abuse and fear for their lives. And there was this one case that we found out about where there was a slave who was trying to get out. And so we had some intelligence on that, and we were working with the local police to find that one particular person and to rescue them. But at the end of the day, when we showed up at the facility, normally maybe you'll go after one person and you'll either rescue that one person, or maybe you'll even find a dozen more people who have been enslaved and that you can rescue at the same time, sometimes a couple of dozen people. This time it was 512 people who were rescued in this one operation that just started with one person who we knew was crying out for release.
And so this 500 you became aware of, were you able to work for their freedom as well?
We were able to bring all 512 of them out of the slave facility. Mm. And when we say rescue, though, we mean something very specific. It's not just finding a whole bunch of people who may or may not be enslaved and pulling them all out. It's when we say rescue, there's actually about 10 different things that we're going through to ensure that, one, they were enslaved in the first place, and to demonstrate that to the government. But it also involves the government then giving them a release certificate, which is a very arduous process to get those certificates and that validation of, yes, this was slavery, no, it cannot happen again. And then they actually are meant to pay reparations to the person who had been enslaved. And then we take that person into a full process of aftercare and long-term healing and transformation of their life, sustainability for the next season of their life now that they are free. So it's actually a really comprehensive process. So it's not just kind of going in and pulling a couple people out.
No, because a lot of those situations could easily return to unless there were good systems in place, right?
Exactly. And yeah, it's really critical to actually work with the government. We never go and try to rescue people just on our own, because what we're trying to do is to take these broken public justice systems and work within them so that they can begin to function in the way that they were always meant to function in the first place.
So this is not helicopters coming in at night and bursting through doors
exactly.
And saving people, right?
It's different. What we really want is a long-term transformation. Mm.
So, Bethany, where do you fit into all this? How does working for this organization come into your story?
Oh, wow. It still blows my mind to think about how I got involved in all this in the first place. What was happening for me was that about a decade ago, actually more than a decade ago, I was in seminary. So I went to a seminary school after I was in college to do what they call a Master of Divinity. And I just had this passion to be a part of
Bible college type thing, right?
Exactly, right, at the master level. And so, but just like that. And really what I was passionate about was about churches all over the world. I wasn't actually going to be a pastor of a particular church, but just had this passion to see a true understanding of the gospel flourish throughout churches all over the world. And so I went to seminary to pursue that. And one day, as coming out of the cafeteria after lunch, just a really normal day, and I remember it clear as day, I walked out of the doors, and I was in this little foyer area, and off to the right was a table way down the hallway. I don't even really know why it caught my eye, but I just started walking towards it, and it turned out that there was a poster hung up at that table, and the poster said this: "Slavery is alive." And then it said, "Rape for profit must be stopped." And those were
that would catch your eye.
Right. Yes. I really, at that point, this was about 2001, I had no idea, one, that slavery actually was alive. I was a history student. I'd studied a lot about slavery all over mm-hmm. the world from, 150 to 400 years ago. I had no idea that slavery was alive today. And then this sentence, "Rape for profit must be stopped," I had no idea that there was something called rape for profit. I actually did have a passion for things like healing of people who had experienced sexual abuse, especially as children, but this idea of an industry that flourished on the rape of children, totally new to me. And so I wandered a little closer to the table, and there was a woman there actually from the Salvation Army, and her name was Lisa, and she had a little sign-up sheet, and all you had to do is put your name down, your email address, and she said she would send information about modern-day slavery, about human trafficking. And, you know, it seemed like such a small step if you think of it now, but it was really the only step. It was the very first opportunity I had to start engaging. And so I put my name down on this little list and started receiving emails from her. And I was just so overwhelmed. I would get flooded with these stories from all over the world of crimes I could never even imagine. And I remember just hanging my hand and my head in my hands one time, just wondering, what can I do? I just felt so paralyzed. And I wrote back to this woman at the Salvation Army, and I remember she told me, she's like, the only way I get out of bed and do this every day is that I remember this battle belongs to God, belongs to the God of justice. It's not our battle. He invites us to join it, and we get to experience hope and victory with him in that. And so about a year or so later, two significant things happened. One, I met the man that I would marry and spend the rest of my life with, Anthony, and he introduced me to an organization called International Justice Mission. And he took me to a little dinner that they were having in D.C. to talk about the work. And it was there that I first started to understand that my passion for the church, for what God is doing all over the world in the realm of drawing people to himself, actually is completely connected to justice and to rescue, that these were not two separate things. And that was when I started to see a whole calling to come together on my life.
That's a great story. Thank you for that. Now, you live, like we do, in the affluent West. So in a sense, you've got a kind of a foot in two very different worlds, I guess, in the sort of work you're doing. Do you find that confronting, that dynamic?
Absolutely. It's really hard to wrap my mind around it a lot of times, actually. I mean, just yesterday I was sitting in this very nice hotel enjoying a really lovely conference with, you know, just all sorts of great people and great ideas to be thinking about. And I had a few minutes extra time, so I opened up my laptop to read through the opening pages of a book that our founder is working on right now for Oxford University Press. And I just received the first draft of his first chapters, and it instantly just transported me right into that grinding brutality of what the most vulnerable people in our world suffer through. And it was, I mean, I was sitting in this, you know, very nice hotel lobby with just, you know, coming to tears, just remembering how much suffering there is, but also just how much hope there is for rescue and new life.
Yeah, well, let's talk a bit about that. The website of your organization says that that the staff stand against violent oppression in response to the Bible's call for justice. And there's a quote from Isaiah from the Old Testament that says, "Seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow." Why is that an important basis for what's being done in your organization?
It's hard to even know where to start because of how important it is. It's the foundation of everything that we do. Justice is certainly, it's a universal idea. You know, there's these concepts of common good. But justice, from what we believe, doesn't begin in kind of a common universal idea, but rather it begins in the character of the God who created the universe, that the God who created the universe actually carries justice as central to who he is, and that's where all of our work flows out. And it changes everything about how we approach every single case, every day of our work, the way we do it together. It shapes that.
Now, you, when you examine, as you do frequently in your work, you examine the terrible injustice and inequality of the world. How do you process that as a Christian? Is this a challenge ever to your faith?
I think it absolutely is a challenge. And yet, one of the things that I remember is what came to Gary when he was standing in those mass graves in Rwanda right after the genocide. And the question that so often comes to mind is, where is God? Where was God when this was happening? And as Gary was standing there and amidst all those bodies who had been macheted to death, and he was thinking, where was God? God turned that question around and said, no, the question is, where are my people? Where are God's people? And I think that's really the challenge before us today, is to realize that justice is the heartbeat of God, and that God is good, and that we can show God's goodness by showing up in the places of deepest darkness in the world and being that light that Jesus tells us we are, the light that can penetrate any darkness. And when we do that, when we show up and we trust that God is the one leading us, then the question of how can this possibly be true goes away, because we start to see just the incredible hope and transformation that God brings when we listen to him and show up.
Well, it sounds like you've found a great intersection, really, of your greatest passion with the greatest need. Good place to be in, Bethany. Right. It's great to hear you talk about it today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. This is such a pleasure.
This is Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. And in this next half of the podcast, Justine Toe and I talk to Ruth Padilla DeBorst. Now, this was one of my favorite conversations. Ruth is a theologian. She's involved in community justice and education initiatives. She's based in Costa Rica with her husband, James, and their multicultural blended family. They're also members of a community called Casa Abode. Memorably for me, before this interview, I knew that Ruth had experienced tragedy in her life, but I didn't know the details of that before the interview. And it was a bit of a shock to me to hear about what was a truly traumatic event in her life, and then how she came to process that. Here's our conversation from 2013.
Ruth, it's great to have you in. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, is that description of the church sort of fading away in the West but thriving elsewhere, is that reflected in your experience of living in various places?
Yes, definitely. Churches of all sorts, churches in garages and under trees and in big buildings and in smaller buildings, the church is growing in Latin America, definitely.
And when people are in poverty, I wonder whether faith is just a distraction, you know, from their misery, or is it something more than that? What's going on there?
I think for some it could be. It is a way to dim the pain. But for many, faith is a whole lot more than that, and it drives them into action, into service, into involvement in all sorts of realms of life. And because of an understanding of that being the calling of Christians in the world.
I wonder if you could comment on the different shape of faith in places of abundant material wealth compared to places that are less so. You've lived in both.
Yeah, I think when we have too much, we trust too much in things and in what things can acquire for us. And we build our security on stuff. When we don't have, we have to really kind of reckon more with who we are as people and what it means to live as a community that can survive and make it and thrive and find ways forward. And understanding as Christians God's presence in the midst of those circumstances in some ways is more available because we're not as trusting in the stuff of our consumer society.
So you mentioned that when faith is really vital for people in these circumstances, that it actually spurs their action to serve. So can you talk us through how the church in Latin America contributes to the common good?
Yes. I mean, I could tell you story after story of people who understand their faith to not be something only private or a Sunday thing or a churchy thing, but something that has to do with the way they live their lives and their priorities and their values. And so, for example, I could tell you of a group of women who, in sight of a current thing that happens in El Salvador, for example, is water is sold in plastic bags, small plastic bags that people can sip as they go on the bus. And people typically toss those bags into the street. And then the rains come but the sewers are stopped up by bags. And so these women realize this problem and realize that really they, as believers in the Creator God, had to be responsible for what happened with their neighborhood. And so they began an entire recycling program that the city did not have. But the church began, 130,000 members start recycling. The city has to do something about it. And it became a model to other sister cities of just responsible citizen engagement with ecological concerns.
I think people today, especially in the West, feel really skeptical about the church and its relationship to power. Mm. Do they have good reason to feel skeptical?
I think so. I think too often when religion is associated to power, it blinds us to the needs of others. It self-legitimizes and doesn't really engage with the issues of the context. And so it's a harder challenge where you're divested from power. Faith can empower, but with a very keen awareness of the needs and the issues of the context so that you can be a part of the solution rather than a part of the problem.
And it is true to say, I'm sure, that the Christian faith has lots of resources when it comes to challenging injustice as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think as a Christian, I believe in the essence of being human and of God being involved in humanity is for just relations, for right relationships, for relationships that really do engender and support life rather than oppress and restrict.
Now, in Australia at the moment, we're in a rather torturous debate about asylum seekers. And I wanted to ask you about this. The issue raises questions around hospitality, fear of the other, and so on. And you've said in the past that God's love doesn't know any boundaries. Can you explain what you mean by that? And do you think that has anything to say to a culture like ours that's wrestling with this difficult problem?
Yeah, I think God is a God of open arms and a God that, as we can read through Scripture, consistently encouraged God's people to open their arms. And the measure of their faith was the test of their faith. Wasn't how many times they prayed or how many services they attended or their religious festivities, but it was justice, and justice particularly to the most marginalized, that would mean widows, would mean orphans, and even strangers, people, foreigners, people from other lands. Even in some cases, they were called to have cities of refuge for criminal foreigners. That was pretty radical. And then you go through into the life of Jesus, and Jesus engages with people, even heals the son of one of the soldiers of the occupying army. So just this concern for the other, the openness to engage and welcome. And I think that is a challenge to any faith community today, is to say, are we being coherent with God's open arms?
Yeah, it's a challenge also. So as a church that exists, or people, as you say, the faith community existing in a very secular culture, though, it's a case of trying to persuade people of the benefit of this sort of approach to people, even if they don't share the same belief.
Right. So I guess the thing is, how do we affirm the value of everyone and the dignity? And of course, there are political implications to the decisions and such, and it's not a simple picture. So I'm not just writing it off as, oh, it's just automatically, you should welcome everyone. But there definitely needs to be a posture of acceptance and open arms.
You're really interested in healthy, thriving communities. What is there beyond economic questions that would indicate such, you know, human flourishing? Because we often talk about, you know, if we're rich, then we're happy. But surely there's more to a good life than that.
Definitely. I think reducing our well-being to economics is a pretty poor definition of well-being, because really what we most need in life are healthy relationships and that sustain, and then being able to build communities that together can find ways forward in spite of the circumstances. And so there are plenty of studies that talk about how with poverty, under a certain line, you obviously are suffering a lot. But beyond covering your minimum needs, having more does not increase happiness. And I think it actually sometimes detracts from it because we trust in things rather than engaging with people.
I want to ask you about this idea of consumerism and the impact that it has on us, because, of course, it doesn't affect me or you, but you know, I'm joking, obviously. It's a terrible sort of disease.
It is. It is a pervasive value of our society that eats at us and consumes our very soul, I believe, because then we trust in what we have. We build up our image based on what we look like and what we own and how we dress. And then there's just an emptiness inside. And so I think, for one, being aware of the needs of others, just linking in to see the way other people live can be a challenge to us and say, well, what exactly is happening here if I have so much and most people have so little? But we need to be able to open our eyes and be receptive to the reality of injustice in our world. And that can start questioning our lifestyle and our priorities. And then I believe the call of the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, as we believe in as Christians, does call us to engagement with others. And that in itself can be an antidote to this consuming consumption.
How about we talk about faith in the midst of suffering? Because when you talk about the Christian faith, it's life-affirming, it's good news. How does that good news sustain people even in such depressed circumstances?
Yes, I think there have been preachers and teachers and Christians have been known to often say, if something is going wrong, that's God's punishment and you deserve it. And we have an example of that in the Bible with Job's friends criticizing him. And that's not the God of the good news of Jesus Christ. It's a God that actually comes into people's suffering and accompanies people in their suffering, chooses to suffer along with. And so knowing that presence and being able to hold on to the confidence of that presence and of God's good purposes for all people, and that suffering is not something that is part of God's agenda to punish anybody. It is actually a result of injustice and our own greed and our own violence and distance from one another.
Ruth, I wonder whether that sense of God's presence in suffering has been reflected in your own experience in some way.
Yes. Several years ago, 16 years ago, actually, my husband and children, we were filming, actually, a bushfire in Ecuador where we lived, and three people approached us armed and did a carjacking, and in the process, they shot my husband, and it was a very dark night, and many people, as they've talked through with me and my grieving process and such, said, well, how can you still believe God is there with something so terrible happening to you and your children? And actually, I experienced at that moment, in the middle of that loss, the sense of God's presence sustaining, not just saying, I'm with you, compassionately, but I actually am suffering with you. And I think that's what the biblical image of Jesus on the cross is God taking on human suffering and giving us a chance for life beyond it. And that's what I've experienced, is life beyond that. That was 16 years ago. And it definitely is painful, but it also opened my eyes to the crazy world we live in, where our values are so distorted that these people feel they can, a car is more valuable than a life. But what happened to them that made them think that, and what happened to their families once they went to jail, and just to such a broken world. And it just opened my eyes to injustice and our distorted values, and began a whole new understanding of God's heart for justice in the midst of the messiness of life.
And Ruth, you sometimes hear people say that Christianity is mostly about securing a kind of ticket to the afterlife, as if it doesn't have a lot of impact on the present.
In what way would you say that's not the picture of Christianity and how you try to live that?
Right. Sadly, I think many people do portray it like that, but I don't think that's the good news we should claim. By God becoming a human being in Jesus and walking the streets of a poor little relegated area of the world, God in a way legitimized history and said, it's good. I'm here. I'm in the midst of history. And we need to live in the midst of the day-to-day issues of our context. And so we're called to be that, to live as Jesus lived, and value the people and the things Jesus valued, and be able to share the life that God has given us with others here today in the midst of all the messiness of life.
Thanks for joining me on Life and Faith today. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and share it with those you think might like the conversation as well. Coming up next week.
I remember once being in a school, seeing a school assembly in a faith-based school, and seeing one of the school leaders, a deputy, sort of lean over the podium at the end of the assembly and pray. And then with his eyes open and kind of glowering out across the assembled students, he prayed something along the lines of, Lord, help us to work hard today and not to run down the corridors and to be respectful to our teachers and to follow the school rules. In Jesus' name, amen.